Can you all hear me? Is this mic working?
No.
No, here we go. Oh, okay. How about now?
No.
Yes? Yes. Thank you. Well, good morning, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And Bob got more applause than I did. Anyway, my sobriety date is December 7th, 1964. And if you're wondering why the schedule got changed, Bob went to the committee and pointed out to them that Sandy was on for 2.5 hours on some very heavy material, probably would be go in over his head. And partway through, it would start falling apart, and it would make the conference look bad. So he decided to be here as a backup and to make sure nothing really got screwed up. The truth is that we really enjoy any opportunity to just play off each other. We just start talking, and after a while we stop, and then the other one picks up, and we go on from there. I was going to start out with some thoughts on the history of AA. I'm not going to talk about the entire history of AA, but I had no interest in history growing up. I hated it in school. It already happened. What the hell you want to look at that for? And the same applied when I got to AA. I was so disinterested in it that I never even went up and met Bill Wilson, which would have been real easy. I'd go to the Bill Wilson dinner. I had about 7 years to do that. And I who wants to meet Bill Wilson? I mean, I need money. I got problems down here. I don't have it. And of course, as time went on, you can realize how much I wish I had gone to at least shake his hand. Then when I took an interest in AA history, probably reading AA Comes of Age and then The Best of All, Not God by Ernest Kurtz, I suddenly realized that anyone who studied this history would become a believer in God, that there was just no way you could read this and not realize that there was a guiding force that was going to save all the alcoholics or give them a chance on the planet, in spite of Bill Wilson. And so, not in spite of his energy, but in spite of what his ideas were and how this ought to be done. And I think when I think about that, because he is my big hero in AA, I got two heroes, Bill Wilson and Chuck Chamberlain. Those are my two people I'd like to sit and talk with for about 200 years and just pick their brain and listen to them answer questions. And by the way, we are going to have, if anybody wants to ask questions, either anything we're talking about or any spiritual point that you're curious about, from 11 to 11:30, there'll be an opportunity there. And then in the afternoon, we'll save some time at the end. If there isn't, we'll just keep on talking. So don't worry about that. But sometimes people do want. I know I had a lot of questions for Chuck. When I think of Bill going in one direction and being corrected, which is kind of what I was going to talk about in terms of history, the first example, of course, was how he initially wanted to sober alcoholics up by telling them all about the spiritual awakening and the mountaintops and the wind was blowing, and he'd go into bars with this experience that he just had and tell the alcoholics, you don't have to be like this anymore. You can have a white light come into your room and you'll be on top of a mountain and the wind will be blowing and your whole life will be transformed. You'll be just like me. It'll be wonderful. And as you can imagine, he got no takers. No one was going, oh good, I'm going to stop drinking and go join you on that. And some of them allowed us how that happened when they drank rum. if they didn't need a Narsha one. And it was Dr. Silkworth who just said, Bill, this is what I think. I think you should hammer home the hopelessness of alcohol before you talk about anything else. And there comes our first step. And how important that is. It's so important it takes up 45 or 50 pages of the big book before you even get to step two. Because unless someone does that 100%, and they realize how necessary the rest of the steps are, they're really not going to take them in the proper way. They have to be taken out of necessity, not out of curiosity. And when you suddenly realize, when I work with new people, I try to convince them that their situation is a lot worse than they think it is. And they may be in jail facing all this, and they go, yeah, but it's a lot worse than that. Let me explain how bad it is. Until they see the fatal nature of it, and then their mind naturally turns to matters of God as the only way out of the dilemma that they're in. So we can thank Dr. Silkworth for that. But the other area that I always like to recollect is in 1937, when Bill had already met Dr. Bob and they were starting to work with some alcoholics out in Akron, and he went back and was getting some from out of town's hospital. He got Hank Parkhurst and Jim Burwell and Fitz Mayo, and Fitz started AA in D.C. where I got sober. And so they were having this success, and he was back out with Dr. Bob, and they started counting up how many they had. And I think they came up with something like 20 or 21 who had a good chunk of sobriety. And it dawned on them that they really had something that could save the alcoholics all over the world, and that it was essential that they get this message out. So they started brainstorming on how to do it, and of course Bill's the champion brainstormer, way ahead of everybody else. And he said, well, it's clear to me that this has to be divided into three parts, that first of all, we need a lot of money. That was always the answer if you came from Wall Street. We need a lot of money, a lot of money. And with the money, we can pay missionaries to go to other cities, meaning alcoholics that they had sober, they would pay them. They could take time off from their job and go out to Des Moines, Iowa, or someplace like that, and then get it started there, and then pay them to go somewhere else. So we clearly need that. And then since the hospitals aren't too happy with us because we throw up all over their rooms and make a lot of noise and other things, we're going to have to start a lot of drunk tanks. And as a matter of fact, I think the idea of chain stores had just started. So he said, we need a chain of drunk tanks all across the country. And then we need a book. We need some sort of literature that'll explain all this. Well, he couldn't go anywhere without the group conscience. Even back then, you had to get the rest of the drunks to go along with whatever the plan was. And they thought that, they didn't buy any of that. What do you mean, chain of drunk paid? Man, I don't get this. But Bill had a trump card that he always played when he was meeting resistance to his ideas. And this trump card was, why, within gunshot range of here, there's tens of thousands of alcoholics that are dying. And if we don't get this word out to them, their deaths will be on your hands. And, oh, okay. So by a very slim margin, he got the okay to go back to New York and raise a lot of money. And he gets back to New York, and he finds out that people aren't that anxious to donate money to sobering alcoholics up. They thought that some of them were sobering up in the Salvation Army and the churches, and he met tremendous resistance and went around all over the place, and it really discouraged him. But you know, the guy had this drive ever since he had his spiritual awakening. Part of that awakening was to pass the message on. It was built in with the awakening. I think it's built into everybody's awakening. That when it happens to you in AA, you just want to go out and show the next person how to have one of these. It's just part of the deal. Anyway, it wasn't going that well, and so he was talking to his brother-in-law, who was helped him out. He paid Leonard Strong, who helped. He paid his way through Towns Hospital four times. And he was talking to him about this, that I'm going to these people and nobody seems to want to help us. And Dr. Strong said, well, you know, I think I know somebody up in the Rockefeller office that I met through someone else, and I could give them a call. And he made the call, and the man remembered him, and it turned out that the person he knew up there was Rockefeller's right-hand man, Willard Richardson. And he kind of passed on what was going to be put in front of Rockefeller to look at in terms of projects to donate to. So they went up there, and Bill talked, and he said, gee, that's fascinating. Would you like to have lunch, and we could talk this over even more? And Bill's going, we're getting close to the money now. And he got so excited about it that he set up a meeting with some of the Rockefeller advisors, who were people, publishers, bankers, the head of the Riverside Church, the chairman of the board. And Bill and Dr. Bob came to town, and they presented to them. And they were so impressed that they decided to send one of their number out to Akron to totally investigate what's going on out there. You know, the hospital and Dr. Bob and the meeting in the Williams House, the Oxford meeting, and prepare a report. And they prepared this report, and they brought it into Rockefeller. And Bill kept waiting for a report on this, and he didn't hear anything. And finally, Mr. Richardson said, well, we talked to him, and he said, I'm very, very impressed with this. I think this is one of the best things ever come up in the world. That's how much I think of this. But I think money will spoil it. So I'm going to donate a small amount of money so that Dr. Bob doesn't lose his house. And it'll give them a little salary. I'll put it in the Riverside Church, and it'll give them a little salary to go on while they go on. But this looks like a word-of-mouth thing to me, and I don't want to mess it up. And so the panel went along with that, and everybody went along with it except Bill. He said, no, 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 he doesn't understand. We need big money. We need a big chain of drunk. We got to raise money. And in spite of what Rockefeller said, Bill was so persuasive, he persuaded that little group of advisors to form a foundation. And then we'll use the foundation to raise the money, because it'll be tax exempt and people may be more than likely to donate to it. And so he created the Alcoholic Foundation, which was the beginning of our World Service and General Service. So that was the first creation, and it got set up, and so he had this Alcoholic Foundation, and he started going out raising money, and nobody would donate to the Alcoholic Foundation. And it just stalled completely. And there was a few other things that happened, but it really stalled, and Bill shifted his attention. And this is where we really are blessed. He said, well, we need a book, and I think we should shift our fundraising activities to writing the book and then selling them all over the country. And so in the middle of the foundation fundraising, he changed the plan to write a book and use that as a means. So in other words, the book was being written primarily to get the money to get this whole thing going. And eventually the book did supply a lot of income into Alcoholics Anonymous, but it certainly didn't right off the bat. And so I'm just going to stop there with the beginning of the big book, and I told Bob he can pick up from there or touch on his favorite part of history. So I'll turn it over to my great friend Bob.
Hi, I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic. Sober since the 10th of December, 1967. Yeah, that's interesting. I do think anybody who would study the history of Alcoholics Anonymous would have to come to the conclusion that there is a God. It is, we are such a ragged group of folks. And was, I mean, it was kind of like Noah's Ark. I mean, there was one of everything that helped form the fellowship. And the most astounding thing is you can't, to me, the thread that winds through it all is that through God's grace and through Bill's great insight, they kept selecting the right thing at every turn. Even when his instinct would be to go raise a lot of money or start hospitals, the other members said, no, we're not going to do that. And Bill would align himself. I mean, Bill really gave up. I mean, he was broke. And he was offered a job, you know, with, $300 or $400 a month at Towns Hospital to do the work over there. He comes back to the group to tell the group that, you know, this is really a great start, you know, if Charles Towns would recognize what we're doing and give it his okay, and we'll reach a lot more people. And just think of that small group of, 10 guys, 15 guys that sat around and said, Bill, this is, and they're in his living room in the house that he's about to lose. They know he's in deep trouble. They know his wife's working at the department store. And his wife and he lived in 52 different places in those 2 years, from about 1937 from 1938 to 1940. They lived in 52 different locations. I mean, you talk about a love story. They had that on television the other night, when love is not enough, for Lois Wilson. But at every turn, whether it was following the advice, Abby comes in, he lights Bill's light about, the Oxford group and the grace of God, and Bill gets inspired, and Bill has a spiritual awakening in Towns Hospital, gets sober in November of 1934. He works with 75 people. No one gets well. One commits suicide in his house. He's having zero luck. No job. And Silkworth comes to him just before he goes down to Akron to do the little proxy fight down there and gives him the information that Sandy talked about, why don't you have to hit him with the physical, with the disease aspect of it before you start hitting them with the spiritual. And that coupled with the comment that Lois made to him before he went down, Bill was tended to depression, and he was really down, and he's saying, no one's getting well, this isn't working. And she said, well, it's working for you, honey. you're sober. So those two little magic pieces came together when he, you went to that retreat in Nashville that where they talk about the phone call from the lobby. I've been in the Mayflower Hotel at that telephone thinking about Bill. So Bill's deals falls through. He's broke. He can't even pay his hotel bill. He's in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel and thinking about having a drink. And he put the idea together that he needed another alcoholic to keep himself sober. Up until that time, he was driven by the spiritual idea of sharing and going to help and change another person's life. He really did not, I don't think, as strongly as he were to have later, understood that he needed a drunk for him to stay sober. He calls Tunks. Tunks gives him a list of 10 names. Henrietta Cyberling was the 10th name. He called 10 different people. Now, you think of how many of us would have stopped at one or two. He called all 10, which to me, in a depressed state in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, I mean, that is the grace of God. By a factor, he goes, meets Henrietta Cyberling, and when he meets Bob, I mean, he comes through with these, he now knows two things that he really didn't know before, that he has to hit him with the physical, and then he explains to Bob that he's really there as much for himself as he is to do any. And that is the thing that everybody kept on saying, you can't talk down to alcoholics. You have to meet them, and that statement where he's there with his own vulnerability saying that I found an answer, but I'm in trouble. I was looking for someone else to talk to, and you were the guy that was giving me, so thanks for giving me the time because it's helping me, go do this. And every turn of our history, it's just by little threads, they pick the right thing, the right tone of the book, the right, you know, that he takes the six steps and expands them, you know, I'm sure you're going to, you know, get into that more. So that's all I have to say on that, and I will give it back to my friend
Sam. Oh, my God.
You all right?
Let the record show he did not use up all his time. Anyway, I'm going to just go back and pick up on the book project. Bill had put together a couple chapters trying to raise money. It was part of his fundraising when he'd talk around. He had his story and more about alcoholism and part of the doctor's opinion. That first section, if you look at that, there's two sections to the doctor's opinion. And the first section ends with, "You can absolutely trust anything these men say to you." Pretty good fundraiser thing, don't you know what I mean? But that wasn't working, and so they sat down. He mainly sat down with his business partner, Hank Parkhurst, who had gotten sober out of Towns Hospital in 1935 or 6. And he was a wheeler dealer, great power driver. He wrote the chapter to the employer because, you know, the beginning of that chapter says, "I used to be in charge of a department with 3,000 people." Well, that was Standard Oil in New Jersey, and that's where he worked. And so after they'd been sober a while, he said, "Why don't you come over and be my partner in New Jersey? I have this little office over there, and we're going to form a little deal so that we can, a co-op, so that gasoline dealers in New Jersey can purchase products cheaper as a big group. And we'll call it the Honor Dealers." And so that's where Bill and Hank would hang out, trying to do a little work on raising money, but they mostly were sobering up drunks who would show up in the office and then they'd sit there and talk to him all day. And Hank had a secretary named Ruth Houck, and she became quite well known in AA history because she ended up being Bill's secretary for 25 or 30 years, and she actually typed the big book in that little office. And so he got talking with Hank about, "Well, how are we going to pay for this book?" And Hank said, "Well, it's real easy. We'll incorporate into a publishing company. We'll get stock certificates, and we'll sell the stock at the AA meetings to the drunks." So Bill said, "Well, how do you incorporate? You don't have to worry about really incorporating. Watch this." And he went into a stationery store. He bought a blank pad of stock certificates, and he just wrote, and he made up the name Works Publishing Company, because the big book was going to be the first in a series of great works that were going to be done by this publishing company. Without checking with Bill, he just signed his down the bottom, "Hank Parker is president." So he just went around Bill and became president on the stock certificates. And they went out and started selling them, and The drunks weren't buying it. "You want us to buy stock in a book that hadn't been written yet? Yeah, but you're going to be in it. We're going to get your stories." "Ah, no, we're not interested in that." So Bill went to Harper's Publishing and showed the chapters that he had there, and the religious editor there said, "Gee, this is pretty good. Can you write something, the whole book?" "Oh, yeah." And he said, "Well, I'll give you a $1,500 advance," which was a lot of money in the 30s. And they got back, and a lot of advisors said, "You ought to take it and then just write the book and share everything with Harper's." But they got back and they said, "No, we want the fellowship to own the book. We don't want the Harper's to be involved in it. So we're going to do our own publishing ourselves." And but that helped sell a few shares of stock that this company was willing to give Bill $1,500 on just the two chapters that had been already written. And so that brought in a little bit of money. Then he got an Irishman who knew a radio broadcaster named Gabriel Heater. And he was very popular and he had a little human interest section in there. And he agreed to allow this Irishman to come on and talk for 2 minutes about his story and the book that was coming out, Alcoholics Anonymous. And this man had a problem staying sober, and so once they got the date for the radio broadcast, Bill got real nervous that he wouldn't make it, wouldn't stay sober. So they got a room in the YMCA in downtown New York, and they had an AA guard on there 24 hours a day for 10 days or whatever it was until he appeared on the Gabriel Heater radio show. And that show caused the drunks to buy some more stock. And Dr. Towns of Towns Hospital bought about $1,000 worth. And so they had assembled enough money to keep on going in terms of raising money for the book. And so they went to a printer. Oh, and they went out and circulated the chapters. Bill wrote all of the chapters except the employer. And then they went out and got the stories. And most of the stories came from Akron because there was a newspaper guy out there who would actually write the stories for the drunks. He would interview them, it'd highlight their things. And so there was a bigger percentage that came from Akron than New York. And in New York, the drunks wrote their own stories. So the ones that were written in New York were twice as long as the ones that were written in Akron. Because if you're writing your own story, you're going to really put a big story in there. So Bill and Hank had to edit it on their own without asking permission, because none of the drunks would have given permission. And then when they saw what had been done, they said, wait a minute, you took out half my story, and they're all upset. And they said, no, we have to reduce it. Anyway, they got the stories in there. And then came the content. And this is where I'm going to just tell this part and then stop. The real content of the 12 steps, how the program works, which Bill postponed to the very last writing how it works, because he knew it was going to cause controversy. Everything that you tried in a group caused controversy. It's just like having a business meeting today. You know there's probably going to be a fist fight. And so he was delaying on doing this, and he knew the forces that were at work. In Akron, and it had a lot to do with the relationship of the Oxford group in Akron and the relationship of the Oxford group in New York. In Akron, it was one big family, and the alcoholics and the non-alcoholics all felt they were just one unit in the Williams home, and they have as many as 70 people in there. And it was very close-knit, and it was also, you got to the God thing the first night. I mean, you know, a new drunk would show up, and then he'd go upstairs with Dr. Bob and somebody else, and they'd go, do you believe in God? Okay, get down on your knees. We're going to start praying. I mean, there was no chance to sit there with God as I understand him. It was, you do know Jesus, don't you? Sit down here. There wasn't any doubt about who the higher power was out in Akron. And it's still a little that way that Akron, Cleveland still publishes the Four Absolutes as a pamphlet, which came that thing. And then in New York, they had a couple of people, Hank being one, and Jim Burwell, who were atheists, who after they hung around the Oxford group for a while, they slowly changed their mind and started going along with the God idea. So their experience told them that you should really save the God thing till later on and make the beginning of the introduction to AA sort of a psychological thing. Well, that's a big difference between Akron and New York. Here we got them. We don't want to talk about God till later, and out here they're going, no, we talk about him first. That's the first thing that happens. So there was this struggle going on about how to handle this God thing. And out of that struggle came God as we understand him. That was the compromise for the former atheists in New York, and they went, okay, I can go along with that.
Do you attribute that phrase to Jim Brewer?
Yeah, or to that argument that was going on. And it's funny you ask that, because if you study Bill's story, when Ebby is calling on him and Bill is showing resistance to the idea of God, Ebby says, well, why don't you come up with your own idea about God? So it was really there all the way back with Ebby, but that was forgotten when they were working on the book. And yes, I believe that it was Burwell, who was a pretty powerful guy and did a lot of wonderful work for AA. Philadelphia is Burwell's territory, Baltimore, and he helped out in Washington, D.C. And I'll tell you a thing about Burwell. He didn't believe that AA should have conferences. That was just his thing. No, we just have groups. We don't have anything beyond that. Philadelphia still doesn't have conferences. Bobby Coyle, some of you may know Bobby, speaks all over the place, and he decided to break the spell, the Burwell spell, and start a conference up there. And he started the Firecracker Roundup on 4th of July weekend. It lasted 2 years before the forces behind the scenes wiped it out. So it's amazing how the influence of whoever started AA in your area still can be carried forward. I mean, it is just amazing. No, we don't do it this way here. Why? I don't have any idea. And it goes, am I right? It goes all the way back to whoever started AA in Houston or Des Moines or whatever it is. And so that's how the compromise was reached, and the steps were circulated, and there was a lot of input that came into them, into how it works. And there was input on all of these, and some of from outside sources, outside of AA. It really from the, I forget who, the, it was a psychiatrist who said, look, you really want to report the steps as in the past tense. We did this rather than you should do it. So it's shifted from the commandment type thing, which none of us would have listened to. And if you look at the big book and you're new, you're not in it. It's reporting about what we did. This is what we did. This is what we did. This is what we did. And then finally it says, and if you want what we have, this is how it's done. Nobody says you must do this. And that's a beautiful technique for keeping our attention, not driving us away in the beginning. So I'll just stop there with the influence that the two, and you know, that's still around. That New York versus Akron. It is just amazing.
Sure, Henrietta Seiberling was always a strong believer that Bob did not get his due. That Bill was a promoter. Bill wrote most of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's probably just the way it is. But those two men never had a disagreement over anything as they went in. And, this joke always was, if Dr. Bob was the sole founder of AA, it is still be an Akron, if Bill was a sole founder, he would have sold it. And the only thing I want to say along with what Sandy talked about is Bill had a strong tendency to depression. And today there's a lot of talk about depression. And the Akron group had 6 steps. And in one of Bill's kind of hypochondriacal thing, and he's got stomach trouble, and he's in bed, and he's down, he took a legal pad and took the 6 steps of the Oxford group in bed on a not a very good day. And through Bill Wilson, God, they expanded them into the 12 steps. And when he was done, he liked the idea that there were 12. Kind of like that. That's a good number. And I mean, he knew that they needed to be expanded and address certain things that the Oxford group wasn't addressing, and tighten up a few things for the Drunks of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I think most of us, to me, the mark of great spiritual literature is that when you read it, it's always new. You think someone added something. You know, where did they put this to? And because of that, and because of the great impact that it had on our society, and because it's still the great impact that it's is still having. I mean, almost everybody believes that Bill was an instrument, that, you know, that someone with his background, with his illness, with his short period of sobriety, he wasn't schooled in that way, couldn't have done it. But what a man, what a gifted writer. But what came through him on a bad day, not of himself, not something that he had been foisting himself. And I think sometimes we underestimate, you know, because we all have bad days. And sometimes it's, I don't know, I just love that he was almost not at his best. And that was the day he wrote the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to take a break for 10 minutes, Sandy, or 15?
Okay.
How long?
Huh? I'm sorry.
How long do you want to take a break for, 10 or 15 minutes?
15.
Okay.
15 minutes. All right, welcome back. We'll just pick up where we left off, continuing with the history around our book. They went to Cornwall Press, and everywhere they went, I left out the Reader's Digest story. That's a wonderful story. The final way that Bill was able to sell stock certificates was because of a visit that they made to the Reader's Digest offices. And they went up there and said, we're in the middle of, they told them all about AA, and Reader's Digest specializes in human interest stories, you know, that are going on affecting the country. And as he told this story to this assistant editor, he was very impressed. And they said, and our book is coming out, and this will be how alcoholics all over. So it's very important that the book be in the story. Oh, yeah, the book will be in the story. When you get that book finished, you just come up and tell us, and we'll be ready to go. And I think they had a circulation of 12 million readers. So when Bill came back to the drunks in the group, he said, hey, Reader's Digest, 12 million. You guys, you better buy this because you're going to make a fortune. We're going to be selling millions of books out there. And so they did, and that helped push the sales up to keep the project going. And when they got the book to the printer, they went back to Reader's Digest and saw the same assistant editor. And he said, we're ready to go. I think his name was Canfield. Mr. Canfield, we're ready to shoot. And he said, shoot what? He said, you remember we were up here a few months ago and we talked about that? He said, oh, yes, I remember that. And I thought it was such a wonderful idea. But when I talked to the top editor, he didn't like it at all, and I forgot to tell you. So they got nothing out of that. So you can see there was just one disappointment after another. But after the book came out, there was an article in Liberty Magazine in 1940, Alcoholics and God by Fulton Ausler, and that brought in a certain number of inquiries. But there was another event that happened at the same time that brought even more inquiries in, and the second one was an anonymity break by a baseball player on the Cleveland Indians, a catcher named Raleigh Helmsley, who caught Bob Feller, if anybody remember Bob Feller way back when, the fastball pitcher. And the story about him is kind of fun. He was a really good athlete as a catcher. But as his drinking picked up, his performance started going down the tubes. And the manager of the Cleveland Indians had heard about the Oxford group and that they could get alcoholics sober. So he went to the local Oxford group in Cleveland and said, can you get my catcher sober? I'll pay you anything. And the Oxford group says, no, we don't take money. But the way for alcoholics right now to get sober, they go down to Akron to a hospital down there. That's where Dr. Bob was. They go through 5 days, and then they come into the group, and then we start working on them, and they get sober. And they say, oh, we can never talk them into going to the hospital. There's no way we can talk them into going to the hospital. So they came up with a plan where they had the opposing pitcher hit him. Not seriously, but just a glancing blow. And the trainer ran out and went, "Oh my God, we got to take you to the hospital." And they took him down to Akron with this serious injury. And he found himself in the alcoholic ward. He got sober. He stayed sober and came back, and his performance started going up, up, up. And his performance got so good that the reporters started interviewing him. "What's going on that now you're such a superstar? And you used to be, oh, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous." And my batting average went up, and this went up, and it was in all the papers all over the country. And more inquiries came off of that anonymity break than the Liberty Magazine article.
And for a brief, just one aside, and probably for the only time in Bill's career, Bill started to get jealous of Helmsley. And Bill started breaking his anonymity. And there was a period of about a year and a half where Bill was very present publicly. And he eventually was a strong proponent and turned on many opportunities to be very public about it. But this was a very brief thing, and Helmsley had a lot to do with
yes.
with his ego.
And people got on Bill, and he finally slowed down. And our anonymity principle is still a wonderful thing. The next thing that caused a big flurry of activity was the Saturday Evening Post article by Jack Alexander, where AA had started to catch on, and Alexander was an investigative reporter that went in and found the true dirt on what was going on. You know, sure, they're out on the outside, they say they're doing good, but if I went in and investigated, I would find out there's something going on. Somebody's making money, there's something going on. So he was a suspicious reporter, and when he came in, they just embraced him, and he became one of AA's biggest fans. And he wrote an article in 1941, he wrote another one in 1950, a follow-up on AA, praising, etc. So there was a lot of inquiries came in off of the Jack Alexander article. Somebody would read it, they would mail him a big book, and then you would get sober from the book. We forget that a lot of early sobriety that in little cities all over the country, the AA got started because one drunk got a book, read it, got sober, and went out and found other alcoholics. So when you read our big book, you really should see that this is being written to someone who's going to do the steps by himself or herself. And then in step 12, and you know, working with others, now comes the best part. Now you're going to go out and find drunks. Pretty soon a society will spring up around you. It sounds so glowing. Yeah, if you go get them. When you're reading that part, you got to realize it's not going to spring up unless you go get them. So anyway, that helped a great deal. And then, out of the blue, Mr. Rockefeller called. And he had been following AA all these years, and he thought that it was just amazing. So he decided to throw a dinner in honor of Alcoholics Anonymous and invite all his big shot buddies in New York. And that's when Bill said, "Here is the money." Finally, after all these trials and tribulations, we're going to hit the jackpot. And so they had tables with the New York friends, and then at each table was one drunk who could tell his story to the people at the table. And that Irishman that we talked about that was on the Gabriel Heater show, Ryan, was at one table, and the people at the table said, "Well, Mr. Ryan, I assume you're in the banking business." He said, "No, I just got out of Greystone Sanitarium last night. But I'm back here." And then they'd listen to his story, and they were just fascinated with these drunks, because, you know, drunks don't have boring stories. So that caught on, and they were all fired up, and Bill gave a talk, and Dr. Bob and Dr. Silkworth and, I don't know, a few others. And Mr. Rockefeller was sick, but his son Nelson came and told why he invited, "This is the most wonderful thing, but I think money will ruin it." And so I'm going to just give them a little money to hold them over. And he gave something like $2,000. And so the rich guys went home and they said, well, he's almost a billionaire. And he gave $1,000. I'm just a millionaire. I'll give $10,000. But they did get some money from the people that were there. And they solicited that list for about 4 years. And at that point, they went back to Rockefeller and they said, we're not going to ever ask for any money again. We're self-sufficient, and we're going to make it on our own. And that became the beginning of every group is self-sufficient. And Bill finally abandoned his idea that we got to get a lot of money. And before I turn over to Bob, Harper's and Saturday Evening Post were tremendous friends of AA. I mean, when the 12 and 12 came out and when AA Comes of Age came out, Bill gave Harper's special permission to print their own 12 and 12 and their own AA Comes of Age. And somebody, one of my friends in California, found me a copy of the one 12 and 12 from Harper's. And they were going to sell it to the libraries and places like that. So they had this real close relationship. That didn't prevent a total reversal in the 60s when an author named Kane, it's a psychologist, decided that AA was no good. And he wrote these long articles. One appeared in Saturday Evening Post and one appeared in Harper's Magazine blasting AA. And so I wish I could get a copy of it, but one of the covers of the Saturday Evening Post, on the cover down in the bottom, said, AA is no good. And this is the magazine that, so it just shows you can't last forever. But those two articles, and that's when I got sober. The articles had just come out, AA Cult or Cure, and Alcoholics Can Get Sober in Spite of AA. And this guy just had something that he didn't like about AA, and he wrote these two articles. They didn't have any effect, except it caused a lot of gossip in AA. We're going to get that guy. We're going to kill him. Letters are going in and all that. And Bill wrote a grapevine article with his measured response, just saying, now, you know, we can learn a lot from our critics. Let's look and see. Maybe a couple of the points he makes are valid. And he really taught us the proper way to react to these things. So there's always great lessons, whether it's good news or bad news. So I'll stop there.
During this time, our experience, this is when Bill in the fellowship is kind of having all the experiences that we're eventually going to end up in our traditions. We talked about anonymity. We talked about no professionalism. We talked about self-support. My understanding was that AA paid back that money that that took over the 4 years from the dinners. But at any rate, it was a wonderful, the gift that Rockefeller gave us to pause and think about the impact of money on our fellowship. Had we become a fellowship that owned property and was involved in a bunch of money, it never would have been. I mean, Rockefeller understood the pluses and the minuses of money. He understood what a volunteer, what a special thing it was, this word of mouth, sort of peer-to-peer. It's a design that has been copied. I don't know what, 300 organizations use our 12 steps and copy, you know, for different issues in living. It's always striking to me that, I mean, here they have this little car polish company. They have the Alcoholic Foundation. It's just, you know, Ruth Hock is Bill's secretary. When the articles came out, when Ausler's article came out, we had 800 inquiries, and they answered them all by hand. When the Jack Alexander article came out, they had 8,000 inquiries, one employee, and they answered them all by hand by volunteers that came in the office and took the letters and handed them out. The impact of the book, when you talk about unity of our message, we were alive, you know, Bill got sober in 34, AA's founding is June the 10th, 1935, when Bob got sober. From June the 10th, 1935 to the writing of the book, we had, in April of 39, we had 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. from April of 39 to 1940 to almost the end of 19, or to the beginning of 1941, we had 1,500 members. And with the Rockefeller dinner, with the Saturday Evening Post, with the publishing of the book, at the end of 1941, we had 8,000 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, having something to send out to show someone what our program was and how it worked, and it was, you know, I mean, the difference in that, I mean, Bill's, you know, what Smitty, what Dr. Bob's son used to talk about, his father saying, is that Bill could see further down the road than any man he ever met. Mm-hmm. And almost everything that Bill, and Bill's been through a few fights, you know, in the fellowship, be it the majority of trustees being alcoholic rather than non-alcoholic, and people thought we'd blow ourselves apart. And there were a couple of things that Bill Wilson wanted to get done before he died, and he pushed and had a big fight about it. But Bill Wilson was a visionary. And if you would, and I think in our fellowship, it's important that at some point in time, I don't know if we need a better history book, because AA Comes of Age is a hard book to read. And Not God is probably one of the best history books we have, but that's a PhD thesis by Ernie Kurtz. And but I really do believe if we had an interesting way, and Not God is an interesting book, to access our history and see the context in which these traditions were brought up, and the context and the wonderful story about how the book was written and all the different players in it, I think we'd have a much larger appreciation for how unique we are and what powerful spiritual principles have guided us to reach. And I was going to talk about it a little bit more this afternoon, but I want to raise it right now because mm-hmm. I want you thinking about it. So the idea that God had to be the answer, that a spiritual side had to be an answer for this illness was a very new idea. Now, there have been people that have been trying to cure all sorts of things on a symptomatic basis with religion, but this was aimed specifically at alcoholics, by alcoholics, and they, number one, said we had a disease. And the disease was kind of unusual in that, you know, we, with the phenomenon of craving, that we had this physical malady, but we also had this quirk of mind that, you know, destined us to our own thinking, we're always going to return to drinking. And so you got a fatal disease, and you can't not, on your own, you can't deal with it, you're going to die. And in order, but the disease is physical, but it's also mental and spiritual. And that the solution has to have a strong spiritual component, or you're not going to get well. I mean, this is very new. But I think what's even a little bit more unique, we are, as a society, we're an oral society. And as a society, we have one of the best BS detectors that you will find. In a meeting, or when someone's giving a talk, we have enormous tolerance for whatever the person says if it's truly of them. But when they start preaching or teaching or getting intellectual or quoting someone else or talking about a third party longer than a minute or something, we don't have much time for it. I mean, because it is... So I think what is... One of the things that is unique and ended up being one of our great treasures in Alcoholics Anonymous, not just that we needed a spiritual solution, the combination of us telling our stories, needing a spiritual solution, and not tolerating any other way of sharing it other than sharing your experience, strength, and hope, not your philosophy, not your theology, not the rules, not what someone should, not your beliefs. We want your experience. Well, if you look today at what most religious movements are examining themselves about, they're examining themselves, they're saying that for the last 30 or 40 years to be a prominent member of our church organization, almost all the attention was on what you believed. And we feel today that the real power of religion is in the transformative power of that religion, to be engaged in a relationship with a power greater than yourself in such a way that it can transform and change and improve your life in a very real way. Well, that would describe pretty much our organization. So it wasn't just that they had to find God, because you could move towards finding God by reading books. They didn't do that at all. They wanted to surrender and understand that you had to find a power greater than yourself. And then when you found the power greater than yourself, it had to be an experience, not just an idea, not just a belief. And that's kind of the only way we listen to each other. We don't give a darn what you believe. We don't get what your theology is. We want the sharing of your experience. Now that is, I mean, I really think in many ways we are, how many clergy have we had come to our rooms and say they've reclaimed their spirituality in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because of this pithy conversation? We have a real conversation about God and how we're related to God. You know, not if he was married, not if he had children, not if his, you know, mother had any more children. We don't care about any of the theology that the other movements do. So I think in a way that gift, I think, and it's been emulated and copied, is extraordinary. Extraordinary. That we've been forced into a relationship with our higher power that is experiential, personal. And today, that's at the growing point of most spiritual movements. It's where everybody wants to be. They're getting off of theology and into the realness of the relationship. Pass.
Thanks, buddy.
Give me a water, will you?
Oh, you need a glass. I can supply that too. I wouldn't make a good waiter. Too impatient. Well, let's see. You remind me of something, which is the role of the big book. One of the fears that Bill had was that the big book would become biblical, that it would take on the attributes of a Bible, something sacred, something that contains all the answers, something that you go to when you have problems. Now, why would he worry about that? Well, people had told him that, showed him in writings where they did studies of spiritual organizations, that when they took their principles and laid them down in writing, the writing became sacred. It just was the way human nature is. And so instead of worshiping God, you worship a book. Instead of going to God for answers, you go to a book for answers. And the big book is a treasure map, but it's not the treasure. The treasure is God. It takes you to God. There's the jackpot. This is not the jackpot. And you'll notice that when he wrote the third and seventh step prayers, in both cases he says, you could say something like this. He didn't even want those words to become cast in concrete, worshipped, adored, and all of that, which they are. They're printed on plastic, and they've saved more lives than whatever. And in both of them, he said, you could make up your own, just something like this. This is the thing. And so it's important to realize that these are principles, and the principles will cause us to have a spiritual awakening. And the spiritual awakening is the point of all the principles. And once you have this awakening and we have this contact established with God, then we just keep improving the contact. How do I make it deeper? How do I continue? How do I do that? And it's when you study spiritual. I read a lot of spiritual history and spiritual books outside of AA, which AA encourages me to do. There's both the 12 and 12 in the big book says, go to the library. They're filled with wonderful books about spirituality. Talk to ministers. Talk to outside people. They'll give you all kinds of ideas on how to improve your relationship with AA. It'll help you see this third step in a greater depth. Doesn't take you out of AA, but it's designed to increase this. And there's a thing called spiritual pride. And it's the damnedest thing. One of the problems with spirituality is it works. It actually makes you happier. It fills you with joy. It's just the most wonderful thing in the world. And that's what it's supposed to do. It lifts you up into a new world that when you open your eyes and you look out, you see a world that you're very comfortable in. And it's absolutely wonderful. But our friend the ego isn't sitting by just allowing this to happen. It helps us look at this differently. And it convinces us that we are now a much better person than we were when we came in. See, we're not being held up there by God any longer. We can hold ourselves up there. We are a better person. I am now this kind of a person. And so my need for God, oddly enough, is reduced by the success that I have. And I actually have the feeling that I'm not as desperate as when I first came in, which is just the opposite of the program, because we want to get more desperate by turning more things over so that we become more dependent. But this thing called spiritual pride has a tendency to do this. And so we can end up totally absorbed in God's work and leave God out. We do this with 12-step work. I'm totally committed. I've got somebody I'm working with every single day. And nothing ensures immunity from drinking like working with other alcoholics. That assures immunity from drinking, not spiritual growth. Immunity from drinking. And so I remember there was a period of 5 years, if I didn't have 20 guys, I'm just going and going. And I'm starting to get irritated inside. These guys are taking too much of my time. They're really bugging me. This is, why am I doing this? These are just regular guys that I'm working with. My connection with God has been put aside because I'm doing God's work. You see how tricky it is? Because it looks good. And your friends will go, boy, you're a hell of an AA member. I'm really proud of you. Look at how hard you're working. Blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, somebody explodes at a meeting. And you go, what happened? He was just doing so much work. So we always have to keep in mind that the goal is God. And one of the last principles of the Oxford movement is one that we don't follow as strongly as they did, and that was that you would seek God's guidance on just about everything you were going to do. I mean, it just became an absolute way of life. Let me think about it, let me reflect, let me see what God wants me to do, and then I would ask somebody else. I sat quietly for quite a while. I feel that this is where I'm being guided. What do you think? And there's this type of process. And I think we shortcut that a lot. I know I do. I come up with, well, this sounds good to me. I'll run it by Bob. And he says, yeah, that sounds good. So it's probably a good plan. But God was left out. And it was the way we do that is we become familiar with God and what his plan is. And we just assume that we know it. And that it's not going to change in various circumstances, even though they're similar to the one last year. We may be going to get different guidance on this one. And so it's a real challenge to not allow dogma to overtake us. I remember when Bob Pearson retired from the New York office, that was one of his fears, that AA would get rigid. You remember that? He gave a talk on rigidity. And that we would suddenly this is the way.
It is moving in that direction.
Huh?
It is moving in that direction.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't want to accuse. I'll let you do it. He's expressing exactly how I feel. I just didn't want to step on any toes, so. Bob, you take over here.
Okay. So I get to be the jerk. It's all human organizations move towards orthodoxy. I don't care if it's a church organization, a government organization. They start to want conformity into how people think. We are a large movement. And as such, I think that we will see and have seen a tendency within our society to have kind of arch conservatism. You know, there'll be groups that are, you know, more conservative, more structured, more brittle, you know, that they feel they have a kind of a handle on what's right and what's wrong, what the book says, what the book doesn't says. We do it right. If you're not, you're going to, you know, go to hell. That I grew up in a religion that was something like that. And in that comes the spiritual pride sort of thing, that it is, you know, we do it right and you do it wrong. And it is, that's a very non-AA, in my opinion, in the 40 years I've been around, that is not a broad attitude. And you will see it more in the franchise groups, you know, because they're copying, you know, they have a strong influence and they're taking an idea of someone, of a leader, and trying to interpret that. And I think there's a, you know, and on the other hand, most of those groups have some of the strongest sponsorship that we see in the country. The meetings are more interesting than most places that you go. So they're, it isn't like the constructionist groups don't have great qualities, you know, to serve them. But I think for the individuals and for the leaders over a period of time, I think what Sandy was talking about, spiritual growth, is stunted by too much concentration on form. And because it's of God, the idea that I do it correctly and you don't is a thought that we ought to be somewhat careful of, because there's like an ownership. It's like I've got the franchise, you know, God spoke to me. Well, he didn't speak to me, he spoke to my sponsor. And or to my sponsor's sponsor. And I just think there's a, when we run into that kind of thinking in any other arena, we don't like it. When we run into it in the hard-shell churches, and you get the impression, you know, that one of your neighbors or your sister just got, you know, inducted into it, and they come over to the house to tell you that you have now been judged sorry. And no, but that's kind of the approach. Even though it's an act of love, and they really want, I mean, there is a message that you don't have what I have, and you're in need of what I have. And I just think there ought to be, we need to be aware of the movement towards orthodoxy. And the use of the book, like the Bible is being used. The book is the menu, it is not the food. You can starve to death eating the menu. And there are a lot of people who know the book better than I do that, you know, may even in some cases have it memorized that I would not go on a fishing trip with. I mean, there, you know, it is, memorizing 164 pages does not guarantee spiritual growth. And it is much more important about how we put those into action in our lives and how we live them, which, and all of us live them imperfectly. But that is where I think the essence of it is. I'm done being a jerk. You can go back.
Now, the reason this is interesting is I've been there. I'm not talking about, you know, I saw this somewhere over there. I can remember a 10-year period, and I was just, I had, and there was something nice about certainty. You know what I mean? if you could lay it out dogmatically, this is it, then you have a certainty thing. And there is no certainty in life. And there's no, you know, Kurtz wrote another book, The Spirituality of Imperfection. We just have to accept that we don't know everything and that there is no guaranteed way of doing anything, but it feels good if you have it. Do you understand what I'm saying? It gives you a comfort feeling to go, there it is, type, laid out this way. If you say these words to the person you're sponsoring regarding step one, you're going to get results beyond anything you've ever seen. Do you follow what I'm saying? And you go, wow, I love this. I love the comfort of certainty. And then I just ended up getting very angry because nobody else was doing it, and I wasn't relying on God at all. I was relying on typewritten pages of information. So I'm just speaking from my own experience. Now, when you go back in history, you got to realize that when AA was brand new, there was a tendency to do this. Clarence Snyder up in Cleveland typed up all kinds of instructions on how to do the steps. He wrote the first, all the pamphlets and how to take meetings to jails, how to take meetings to hospitals, what you do with a new person. It was really laid out because it's brand new and you think you might have to do that. Cincinnati did it. Akron did it. And if you go online, you can find these early instructions that were laid out in different parts of the country on precisely how to sponsor someone, precisely how to do this. What happens is, you know, 70 years later, somebody gets a copy of that and forms a group around it, and you now have the official way. And the official way produces much higher results. Have you all been involved in this? That the old way, there was a much higher percentage of people got sober. And today we have atrocious levels. And fortunately, there was two or three guys down in Texas who put a paper out that the ratio is exactly the same today as it was back in the 40s. Because the counting has to be done on people who sincerely try the program, not people who were bussed there by a treatment center. There were 100 people at the meeting and only two of them got sober. So the percentage today is really terrible. And anyway, these are just things. And also in some of the groups back then, I know in Cleveland, I think in Akron, especially in Cleveland, in order to get in the group, you had to have taken all the steps, you had to have a sponsor, and you had to have three people vouch for you. Now, if you start with that as a starting point, your recovery rate's going to be pretty high. You know what I mean? If you're just measuring success based on people who've already done this, so you're going to go, look, we're getting 90% people are getting sober here. Yeah, I understand that. If we did that before you could get in my group, our numbers would go up. So anyway, these things are around, and they're probably fun for a while. But I go back to the final paragraph in the big book. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. So if all the experts that wrote the big book know only a little, then there's only a little in the book. And where does all the rest come from? In the next sentence, God will constantly disclose more to us if your house is in order. You can't transmit something you don't have. So the thing that is really being hammered home inside of me is how important contact with God is. That's where the answers are. That's where the comfort is. That's where the intuitive guidance comes from. And as much as I love the comfort of dogma, it makes you feel like you're safer. It lets you down in the final analysis. Or am I wrong, Bob? I'm waiting for him one time to go, you're totally wrong, and then go off on another tangent.
I think it's obvious.
Huh?